Datadog is a SaaS cloud monitoring and security platform that enables full-stack observability for modern infrastructure and applications at any scale, providing teams dashboarding, alerting, application performance monitoring, infrastructure monitoring, UX monitoring, security monitoring, and log management in one tightly integrated platform, plus 450-plus out-of-the-box integrations with technologies including cloud providers, databases, and web servers. Aggregate all your data into one platform for seamless correlation, enabling teams to troubleshoot and collaborate together in one place, preventing downtime and enhancing performance and reliability. Get started with a free 14-day trial by visiting datadog.com/cloudcast. That's datadog.com/cloudcast.
Cloudcast Media presents from the Massive Studios in Raleigh, North Carolina. This is The Cloudcast with Aaron Delp and Brian Gracely, bringing you the best of cloud computing from around the world.
Good morning, good evening, wherever you are. Welcome back to the Cloudcast. We are coming to you live from the Massive Cloudcast studios here in Raleigh, North Carolina. Hope everybody is doing well, and we are getting real close to the end of the year. We are in the middle of December, and what we're going to do on today's Sunday Perspective show is we're going to use it to answer a whole bunch of the questions that you've asked over the years. So this is going to be sort of our annual mailbag question and answer show. You know, we've done this a number of times in the past. I'll put some links in the show notes. It's interesting, as we look at the questions that come in, there are times when we get the same question, and we're going to try not to answer too many of the same questions because sometimes the answers are just the same. But sometimes it is worth answering a question again because obviously the timing and the context of certain things have changed. So anyways, we'll put a link to the show in the show notes for past shows. We've done these the last few years. We've been very fortunate to have a number of good questions from our audience, from our community. So we thank you for that. Sometimes we'll answer them directly to you. We'll shoot you an email directly back. Sometimes we've done some shows specifically about certain questions, and then what we try and do is collect a whole bunch of them towards the end of the year. Gives us a chance to answer a bunch of questions. So we're going to go about doing that. Excited to dig into it. A lot of good questions this year, a lot of sort of bigger picture questions, which is nice. Sometimes we get the very small minutia ones, which, you know, probably are easier to answer via email and so forth. So I think I've got about 7 or 8 this year that I think are pretty good. Will get us, give us a good, robust podcast to dig into. I'm going to go ahead and dive into that, and we'll get into the question and answer right after the break. Are you getting pressure from finance to justify or reduce your cloud bill? Cloud Zero is the only cloud cost platform loved by engineers and trusted by finance. Cloud Zero can identify unused, idle, or over-provisioned resources, alert you to spend anomalies, and organize 100% of your spend into a framework that mirrors your business structure, like cost per customer, product feature, or team. It's the most powerful platform ever built to provide accurate, granular visibility into your total cloud spend without the typical pitfalls of legacy cloud cost management tools, like endless tagging or clunky Kubernetes support. Manage cost, optimize development, and maximize profit, all in one platform. Join companies like Rapid7, Drift, and SeatGeek by visiting cloudzero.com/cloudcast to get started. That's cloudzero.com/cloudcast. Visit today to experience immediate and ongoing savings on your cloud bill. And we're back. And as I mentioned at the top of the show, we're going to dig into your questions. We're going to dig into the mailbag and find a good set of questions from you that you've sent in this year. If you have any questions, if you have comments and feedback, you can always send them to show@thecloudcast.net. We always appreciate them. We always do our best to try and get back to them as soon as possible. But also, you know, when they are good, bold questions, sometimes we hang on to them or we use them as content for the podcast. And you know, as I mentioned before, we've done some of these as exclusive for a single show, an entire show about a question. In other cases, we've responded back to you. But we also, you know, when there's a bunch of good ones that we get, and oftentimes we get them kind of second half of the year because people are trying to figure out like, what's coming next and how do I plan for the year? We sort of save up sometimes the last, 3, 4, 5 months of the year. That's also, I think, the time when a lot of the trade shows are coming out and people are thinking about the future. So a lot of good questions. Again, show@thecloudcast.net. If you've got questions, maybe you want to get featured here on a future mailbag. We typically do these at least once a year, sometimes twice a year. So I grabbed together, I think about 7, 8, maybe 8 or 9 questions that I think are going to be very, very interesting. Interested to dive into them, and as always, we're always interested in your feedback on what are our opinions on your question. So, anyways, let's dive into it. First question is: what are the bigger picture dynamics happening around open source? So good question. Obviously, it's a topic that has been much discussed, much questioned, much interest around this space, because obviously open source plays a huge role in a lot of the things that, we do day to day, whether we directly interact with open source or, you know, indirectly, it's, you know, it's helping to build the applications that we love the most, or it's helping us, you know, build technology that is, you know, helping us scale businesses or secure businesses or, you know, do other types of things. So open source plays a role in probably most of the people's lives that are listening to the show and sort of the markets that are adjacent to us. A couple of things. So at a high level, I think open source today has sort of established themselves in two real areas. Number one, it is become the place where standards for the internet essentially happen, right? If you were to go back a number of years, there were distinct kind of standards bodies, and I think they still exist to a certain extent. You just don't really hear much about them. Things like the WC3 or the ITF or the IEEE or, you know, whatever it might be, you know, kind of groups that were, you know, a consortium of a lot of different smart people from different companies and individuals and universities and governments and stuff would get together to sort of try and create standards, oftentimes sort of paper standards, and then an implementation would follow after that. Open source has essentially kind of taken that role in which, you know, a new sets of technologies can come along. The market can essentially vote for them in real time, if you will, through, you know, stars and usage and all sorts of things like that. And so, you know, it's become sort of, I don't want to say open source is the de facto standard. In many cases it is, but it is the place where standards get created. I think the other big thing that open source still does and continues to do is it is the place where a very large percentage of innovation happens. And this doesn't necessarily mean that all innovation happens there. There's plenty of good ideas that will probably never be open source. But, you know, oftentimes whether it is sort of an original idea or it is a clone of something proprietary that then expands out because the community now has an ability to rapidly evolve it to you know, specific types of needs. I think open source is still very much a place where innovation happens, and we see different, you know, users and companies and businesses and governments and, you know, look to open source as maybe a starting point for a lot of their innovation. So from that perspective, I think open source is really, really healthy. From the perspective of the thing that made a lot of news this year, maybe last year, was around licensing and license changes. And in particular, you know, HashiCorp was kind of the center of that. But, you know, I think this is sort of the new reality that open source faces. And it's not totally a reality, right? We've always seen instances where popular open source projects maybe are either commercialized by a single company or multiple companies, or they're originated by a single company. And, you know, other companies looked at that and said, boy, people are interested in this. We have mechanisms to commercialize it or turn it into a cloud service or whatever it might be, create a clone. And they've gone about using the power of open source licensing, which allows them to take and copy and redistribute and so forth, depending on the license. You know, so there's always been a tension between whoever is driving a project and then something sort of cloning it, not necessarily forking it, but, you know, once it sort of becomes commercialized, like in the case of HashiCorp, somebody else creating a clone of it and then commercializing it as well. And the dynamics of that commercialization or that market competition is less favorable for the origination company than it was maybe when they started the project, right? And we've seen this with a number of things. So, you know, it's an ongoing thing that's always been there. It's always been the risk of open source in that open source is interesting in the context of I can use open source to rally a lot of people around an idea. I can use it as sort of a way of creating a free tier around marketing to get technology out to people, and people can use it and experiment with it and get their feedback and determine if it's useful without having to go through big, long sales processes and very, very expensive marketing. But the downside of it has been it doesn't really have sort of the inherent safeguards that proprietary or patent locked technology might have. So, you know, I don't know that the dynamics are hugely different. Obviously, they're much different now that people don't necessarily always think about open source as just software. They often think of it as, you know, software, but also cloud services in which somebody has operationalized the software and they've changed the value dynamic from maybe support to operationalizing it. And I think that part has changed significantly over the last 4 or 5 years. But the dynamics of open source haven't necessarily changed. Now, it has educated some folks that maybe didn't necessarily think about this. And I think it's going to come into play in even more things, right? So we've seen it, for example, in the context of AI with some of these LLMs, large language models, in which they might be put out or marketed as open source. So for example, Facebook's Llama or Llama 2 came out and Facebook said, hey, this is an open source project. But when you got into the fine print of it, of the license or the thing that they put out along with the project, you know, it had some caveats and limitations of you could not freely copy it or distribute it. It wasn't sort of a, you know, copy restriction. It was based on kind of trying to put a competitive dynamic around it. So I think at the time it was, you know, you can't use this if you have more than 700,000 customers or something along those lines. So it was sort of open source for, you know, a lot of stuff, but sort of not open source with an eye towards like, I don't want my other big competitors to be able to sort of, you know, use this. And, you know, so I think we're going to, you know, especially in the AI space where, you know, a definition of open source might be harder to define. Like, am I open sourcing the data with it? Where did the data come from? Do I have the rights to deal with that data? Are the weights and biases that are built into the system going to be open source, or do you kind of, are we going to give you kind of a guidance for that? So I think we're going to get into some, I don't want to call it open source washing, but we're going to get into some kind of gray areas of what is sort of classic open source versus kind of open and freely available and other things. And the open source kind of community will claim, well, you know, we've had licenses for these things for a long time. And that's true. I mean, there are different ways of licensing stuff. But I think as more and more technology becomes mainstream, you know, the nuances of that are going to kind of jump out for people that hadn't necessarily had to think about those sort of aspects. So anyways, we'll try and get into some of that stuff here in 2024. I think it's going to be a fascinating topic. But those are some of the bigger picture dynamics happening around open source. Other smaller dynamics like, you know, how do we compensate maintainers and how do we avoid burnout and how do we avoid having, you know, the one project that the whole internet is responsible for that's maintained by some, you know, guy in Nebraska that does it part-time out of his garage. Like, you know, those, all those dynamics still exist. So we're not going to dive into those too much. Okay. Second question. And boy, that one took about 8 minutes. So I don't know if we'll get through all these, but we'll do the best we can. Lots of companies talking about wanting to modernize applications, but it seems really complicated. Yes, true. Modernizing an application, depending on what your definition of modernization is, can be complicated. In some cases, it can be very simple. You just, you know, sort of move it to a newer platform that scales better or, you know, runs faster, you know. But and so the real question is there anything on the horizon to make it easier? I think the answer to this question is, in a simple sort of yes and no, not necessarily. There's never been a silver bullet for modernizing applications. It's always been a kind of a plethora of various types of things that, depending on what you were hoping to get out of the modernization, could be really helpful and fairly straightforward. In other cases, you know, it may be a sort of significant heavy shift and lift, lift and shift, but it also, you know, dealt with the situation you were in. So let me kind of break that down to a certain extent. So there are going to be people that have different definitions of modernization. In some cases, you know, the reason you I think the first thing to really look at when you get the question of like modernizing is like, why are you trying to modernize? Is the application not able to keep up with the pace of change that you're trying to deal with? Okay, that's a valid reason. Is the technology that you're using in the current application going away, or are the economics of it changing significantly, i.e. the licensing cost is going way up, or maybe the people that built the application no longer exist, maybe the company doesn't exist, or, you know, is the case that people talk about like with mainframe and COBOL, like the people have retired, or, you know, whatever, like, has something changed economically in the application? Like, that's a valid reason. You know, you may look at it and say the way the application works today, it works fine. But, you know, looking forward a year or two or four or five or whatever, looking at the competitive dynamics of our market, the way that this application works, the way that we update it, you know, the dynamic of it, the way it scales, whatever it might be, just doesn't work. And it's not going to work for us. And so we have to do that. And I think the answer to those different questions is going to impact what your definition of modernization means, right? So if you are looking at it from a technology perspective, like the technology that underlies this doesn't work, there are lots of ways to move it to more modern things, right? So we've seen people move from Unix to Linux. We've seen people move from, you know, proprietary hardware to x86 or even ARM technologies, right? So there's sort of basic foundational things that you can move from a proprietary thing to something that's more open. And usually there are, you know, ways to do that. Is it super simple? Sometimes you have to go through and figure out like, okay, how many of the features do we still need and so forth. But that those sort of things are there's lots of things like that in place, right? We've seen people say, well, move from, you know, VMs to containers and things like that, or move an application from the data center into the cloud. Those to a certain extent are all sort of thought of as modernizations to a certain extent, right? You may not define them as modernization because you might say, well, you know, the application still runs the same. There's no change to the user interface. There's no change to the backend database. There's no change to, you know, how well it scales. But again, this is where the definition of modernization comes in, right? It's going to mean different things to different people. Now, if the economics of your system change, right, maybe the licensing model change, this is oftentimes where the economics that you're facing might look really bad, right? You go look at it and you go, well, that was a bad day. We just got a big license thing, right? Or license change. Or again, the people that were working on it are no longer available. Those can seem really bad. Those are often where you start to look at modernization not as kind of a transitional thing, but you start to consider bigger changes to things. You might say, well, this might force us to rewrite the application. Right. And we've seen lots of examples of that. Is that easy? No, not necessarily. Will things like AI help with that? Maybe, right? Like we're starting to see some things that are like, you know, use AI to help you transition from COBOL to Java, or, you know, help rewrite this application, you know, this source code in a more modern way, or break it up, you know, like, so you might see some things like that. You very well might look at it and say, boy, 2/3 of this thing could be replaced with just a standard SaaS service, right? Like it no longer is unique. We could replace it and we only have to look at 1/3 of it. So those just give you a couple of examples that when you talk about modernization, or if it comes up in the business that you're in, or you know, the business comes to you and says, that piece of technology feels like it's really holding us back, you kind of have to dig into, well, beyond just the you don't like the technology, you don't like a user interface, you don't like the fact that it runs on some weird device or whatever, what are the things that are forcing you to dislike it? What are the options that you have available to you? What are you willing to do, right? And again, the willingness oftentimes could involve cost. It could involve number of people involved. It could involve time. All these things are play a role in this, right? So you know, that was a complete non-answer, but also I hope it highlights that modernization is this big catch-all phrase that means a lot of different things to a lot of different people. And no two applications are necessarily, or no two businesses are necessarily trying to do the same thing with modernization that another company is. So, you know, again, maybe we should do another show about kind of all the variations of modernization and what we see works and what we see doesn't work. Actually, that might be a really good series of shows now that I think about it. It's a good question. Thank you for that. But there isn't sort of a silver bullet. And yes, there will be things to make parts of it easier, but there's never going to be just the easy button that you just, you know, point something at, you know, a complex application today and boom, it's just going to be better. So anyways, third question. What have you seen as the most important thing to make modernization work? Very good question. Again, going to give you kind of a consultant answer. It depends. I think if I, and I'm going to, we're actually going to do hopefully a really good show about this, in January when we get into some of the look ahead shows. But I think we've all sort of learned, if you've been around things for a while, that the people and the alignment of your organization and prioritization of what motivates people, how they're measured, what their incentives are, is probably going to be as important, more important, 10 times as important as the technology that you choose. And the reason I say that is, you know, I've seen plenty of organizations who have lots, they can check all the boxes. We have the best cloud and we have the best open source and we use the cool technology that's, you know, at the top of the list of the best programming languages to use. And then you still talk to them and you go, so why are you 4 years into a cloud transition? Why are you 3 or 4 years into moving to microservices? And what you realize is, you know, they adopted new technologies. Everybody got to update their resume and they made very few changes to how the organization was kind of put together, how it was prioritized, how they, you know, lumped together. Could things get done by themselves or did they require 10 different groups to sign off and all that stuff? So I think the most important thing ultimately comes down to how you organize yourself. And I will leave this as a teaser. We are going to do a really interesting show, like I said, in January, based on some really good research that's been done recently with some friends. And we're going to dive into that more in January. So hopefully that all works out. Okay. Shifting gears a little bit. Do you have any thoughts on Broadcom taking over VMware? Good question. We have some thoughts. I think we've talked on the show about this somewhat. You know, this is going to be a really interesting thing. So first and foremost, you know, I know a lot of the headlines around the Broadcom acquisition of VMware initially were, this is a huge amount of money. So, you know, there's always the sort of, hey, let's give it a trophy for being a lot of money. And then obviously the second piece becomes, you know, what products are going to get kept around. I think we're starting to see that trickle out. We'll put some links in the show notes. We'll definitely cover it in the year-end show. Third piece of it, unfortunately, you know, is the announcement that a lot of jobs got cut. And, you know, our condolences and our feelings go out to anybody who's impacted by this. There are, you know, we've got lots of friends at VMware. We've known a lot of VMware people over the years. VMware has been, you know, a part of this show indirectly or indirectly for a long time. So, you know, we never love that part of acquisitions. That's the unfortunate part of our industry. It's the unfortunate part of unfortunately a lot of acquisitions and mergers and so forth. You know, I think it's a little too early to figure out what Broadcom taking over VMware is going to be, right? The reason I say that is because VMware, the virtualization technology, the core thing that is so embedded in so many enterprises is, you know, it's just, you know, it's like oxygen. It's like water. It's just there. And there are so many people that have built their careers around that, that while there will be lots of discussion around what happens next to it, whether prices go way up or things get bundled together and people are sort of like, oh, wow, this changed the economics of how we see VMware, or here's some alternative virtualization technologies, or here's some alternative cloud technologies to VMware. You know, VMware is a foundational technology, and foundational technologies don't tend to change very quickly because so many things are dependent upon it, right? So this is, you know, about VMware and VMware technologies, but it's also about, boy, how many things are dependent on VMware in your company, in your competitor's company. And so, you know, I think there will be pressure because of, you know, the people impacts and the financial impacts that Broadcom will create in the VMware ecosystem. But I also think it won't necessarily happen as fast as people think. And this is an area where, you know, we may be completely wrong about this. We may find that people are just like, you know, the economics, you know, the economy has changed somewhat, interest rates have changed somewhat, you know, our priorities have changed somewhat. And, you know, this thing has really pushed us over the edge, right? And I know Aaron and I have talked about this somewhat, both on the show and off the show. There are lots of people who will tell you, boy, we're frustrated with this VMware situation. And by frustrated, they don't necessarily mean technology frustrated. They mean economics frustrated and uncertainty frustrated. But getting people to then act on that frustration is oftentimes a very different context, a very different, you know, dynamic than just being frustrated about things. So I think that for now, and again, we'll talk about it on the end of your show, I think there's going to be a lot of wait and see, right? There has been a lot of uncertainty around this acquisition. It's taken a very, very, very long time. There's been all sorts of speculations and rumors and, you know, misinformation and stuff. I think a lot of people are going to go, okay, let's just sort of see what happens. Let's see if you follow through on your promises. Let's see how many changes you try and implement right away, because obviously you've got huge amounts of debt to try and service and try and, you know, reconstitute VMware within the bigger, you know, the bigger framework of how Broadcom does things. Anyways, I just think there's going to be a lot going on there that that people are going to have to digest. And again, they're not going to do it right now because it's the holidays, but they will be, you know, looking into it come January, February, March, all those sorts of things. Okay. Question five. Has anything really changed in the dynamics between the three big cloud providers, or do you expect AWS to just stay in the lead for the foreseeable future? Good question. Something that I kind of touched on, I think, last week on the show in terms of, you know, reviewing AWS reInvent. And I called it, you know, kind of how AWS is dealing with day two. You know, AWS famously likes to call every day day one as if, you know, the sky's the limit all the time and we're always looking to the future and, you know, all that sort of stuff. But I think they are at a day two stage where, number one, they've got new leadership. So again, different people in charge oftentimes means just different perspective. And sometimes that perspective could be 100% aligned to the past. It could be 93% aligned to the past. It could be 87% aligned to the past or 50% aligned to the past. But the past, as we often hear from our financial advisors, does not guarantee what's going to happen in the future, right? It can influence us and educate us. But, you know, I think AWS is in an interesting transition. Obviously, their business continues to grow. Their rate of growth slows down. And those of you who, you know, like to do numbers will say, hey, you can't grow at 80% on large numbers forever. Yep, totally understand that. But, you know, by any measure, AWS is not necessarily the rocket ship that it was, you know, pre-COVID. So that's sort of a reality. They're still growing well. They're still the number one cloud. They still are up to the right of Gartner and all those wonderful things. AI is potentially going to be a huge thing in our industry. And right now there is lots of uncertainty about how impactful it will be, right? And I explicitly say lots of uncertainty because anytime there's uncertainty, it means who knows. It means you will see various types of actors potentially act rationally, but also potentially act irrationally or make bigger bets than they did when the game seemed to be fairly stable and have, you know, mostly knowns. The economics of the world are slightly different. The politics of the world are changing and evolving and maybe a little more volatile than they've been. And so, you know, to fully expect that the company that maybe for the last 7-8 years has been winning is absolutely guaranteed to be winning going forward, I think the tech industry has proven numerous times that, you know, the winner of one decade or the winner of one era is not necessarily guaranteed to be the winner of the next era, right? Oftentimes they're, you know, they're in a good position starting, but it doesn't necessarily guarantee it. So I think we will have a bunch of interesting discussions as we get into 2024 of, are we really at the beginning of a new era? Is AI sort of the beginning of a new era? Is it just a fad? Is it just a technology trend? Is it just a feature? Who knows, right? We'll dive into that. Actually, we're going to dive into that here in a show, I think, next week. You know, I think the thing to think about is, you know, the ordering of the big three clouds may or may not stay the same, right? You know, right now they feel far enough apart that, you know, in any given year, they'll probably stay, you know, probably about the same this time next year, maybe the year after. But I think there are some very, very big dynamics at play that, you know, could change the dynamics of the three. They could get closer together. One and two could flip, two and three could flip. A third player could come in that isn't necessarily going to be a 70 or 80 or $100 billion player, but could begin to, you know, significantly change things. Maybe it's a NVIDIA DGX cloud or something along those lines. So, you know, I think we're thinking of it in terms of, are we at a new phase of the cloud or a new phase of sort of computing and technology? And if that's the case, then you have to look at it differently than just, you know, is this AI thing just a new feature, right? So we will most definitely be digging into that in 2024. Okay. Next question. There have been a bunch of shows about AI lately. And the question is, if I'm not a data scientist, or let's just sort of generically say, like, if your world isn't exclusively around AI, should I be listening to those shows? And it's a fair question. I think we could probably have rephrased this question as, There have been a bunch of X shows lately. They could be about cloud cost savings or platform engineering or, you know, developing around serverless or migrating to the cloud or any of those things. And if, you know, that's not my day-to-day job, should I still be listening to these shows? And, you know, first and foremost, that's a, as my kids often say, like, that's a you question. You know, should you dedicate your time to something that's not explicitly to you? Well, that's going to be exclusively, you know, whether you think what we do is valuable. I think what we've found over time, and this is Aaron and I speaking as people who have, you know, not exclusively stayed in one domain in technology, is we're obviously never going to know everything. We're never going to know everything in depth, but we've often found in our career that having some sense of, well, what's adjacent to what I do? What are the trends of things that I do are useful to know for a number of reasons. One, you know, there's never sort of one technology that dominates everything, at least in cloud and enterprise IT in the space that we work in. So it's worth knowing what else is out there. It might help you. It might be beneficial to what you're working on. Number two, there will never be one group, one technology that gets all the budget, right? The people that lead your organizations that are running businesses large and small are always having to make trade-offs. How much do I dedicate to things that impact my customers? How much do I do things that impact the back office of my systems? How much do I do that's future-looking innovation? And so understanding what else is out there, how much money is being spent in that space. So those are always useful sort of things. So, you know, I think the answer to this is, hey, if we put out some shows that, you know, just absolutely you have no interest in, like, no offense, that's fine. Hey, you know, it would be great for us if you just clicked play and let it run for 3 or 4 minutes, and, you know, we get a listen in the record keeping. It helps us, you know, learn about the show and so forth. But yeah, please don't feel like, you know, if the show isn't specifically about something that you really care about, that you need to give us 30 minutes of your time. We realize your time's valuable. So, you know, it is something that we've always tried to figure out. The show is, how do we have a broad mix of topics such that we're not only doing one thing? You know, we also realize that, you know, there are going to be times, and we've seen this, you know, over the years, whether it's around security or crypto, now with AI and other things in the past, there are going to be lots of other podcasts that you might choose to use or listen to that are explicit about one thing or another. And, you know, we have to be conscious that we try and do our best to be a broad mix of things. But, you know, sometimes when big trends happen, we will, you know, we'll try and dive into it somewhat because, A, they're interesting to us, but also we think, you know, some depth would be useful for everybody. All right, I got two questions left. I'm going to try and get through them here in 5 or 6 minutes or any of those sort of things. Okay, question number 8. A bunch of us at work are experimenting with various AI technologies, but we've been told by our employer that it might violate some legal issues or expose some work data to the internet. Any thoughts? So this is a great question. And this is a great question for a couple reasons. One, it's relevant to today and will probably be relevant to a lot of people in their day-to-day jobs. But it's also relevant for any of you that listened to the sort of three-part series we did on sort of the history of cloud and the various stages of cloud computing or, you know, technology and so forth, because this is not a unique phenomenon, right? I often say that technology doesn't always repeat itself, but it often rhymes. And for those of you that are, you know, probably past 35 or 40 or so, you will remember this. We used to have a concept called shadow IT. And essentially that was, there are lots of interesting technologies that are starting to emerge, but, you know, they require us to get to the internet a certain way, or they require, you know, they're asking us for certain personal information or whatever it might be. And a lot of businesses were like, nope, we're not going to cut you off from the internet, but we don't want you to just sort of be freely spending time on the internet. And back then it was typically less about, are we exposing lots of data to the internet? I mean, there's always that. There's always, you know, which way should the firewall be set up? And, you know, but it was, how much time are people spending, you know, wasting time on the internet, you know, wasting time on dating sites or on Facebook or on Twitter or looking at videos, or, you know, if they're spending lots of time exchanging music through Napster, and like universities used to have this problem, how much of our bandwidth is being taken up by that? And how much of our bandwidth should be taken up by that, right? So there has been a trend in the past of, you know, the internet unlocks and opened up a lot of things that people are interested in. Should they be doing that during work hours, or should they be doing that at home? And the company and central IT and other things oftentimes, you know, had to figure out what was the right balance. And in many cases, because there's not necessarily one right answer, they'll often come back and go, well, we're shutting things off. And so that's kind of what's happening. And we've heard this from various companies we've seen this at Microsoft. You know, we've seen some of the ironic ones where, for example, like Microsoft told people, hey, you shouldn't be using ChatGPT because it might give bad answers or it might expose company data, even though Microsoft is one of the largest investors in OpenAI. We've seen other things happen where, again, and I've seen this at some of my companies and Aaron's companies and others, where they've said, hey, we're not exactly sure. We haven't evaluated those things yet. So please don't use them for certain purposes, right? Whether it's a marketing purpose or whether it's, you know, whatever the engagement was. And so I think what we're seeing is a couple of things, and we're going to see this with AI. There's probably going to be two, three kind of big concerns that businesses will have about AI. The first one is going to be, you know, if you're using it in some mechanism and the output of AI is intended to represent the company, and there's a chance that the output, so for example, like let's say you're just copying things from ChatGPT as answers, or you're using an LLM or something to be a chatbot, and it runs the risk of, or I shouldn't say it runs a risk, it creates a hallucination, which is just kind of part of how the model works, right? And the answer is wrong or incorrect or skewed in a certain way. There are going to be businesses who are going to be concerned that, you know, if incorrect or invalid or skewed or hallucinated information goes out to our customers, that is a risk to our business, right? And I understand that line of thinking, right? A lot of this is going to be us kind of getting used to the idea of how much do we trust these AIs? How much are we okay? You know, how do we measure if their feedback is valid or invalid, right? So there's going to be some of that concern. The second concern is going to be, how are you interacting with them? And are you interacting with them in ways in which you're using our company data that should not be shared with the public, but the way that you're interacting with the system is shared with the public, or I shouldn't say shared with public, is used to model or train or improve a public model with our private data. And hence, people might just randomly ask a question like, hey, you know, how does company X do their secret process for doing this thing? And it pops out an answer and it's like, whoa, that shouldn't have made its way out into the public domain. So there's going to be the sort of data concern, data privacy concern will come up. And the third one is going to be, how are we paying for these things? Because right now, while you might be able to swipe a credit card for $10 or $20 or $50 a month or whatever it might be, how do companies get a handle on that when there's 1,000 people doing it? Or, you know, oh, you're running an LLM internally. Like, are you doing that on a bunch of GPUs? What cloud cost are you running up, you know, bill, right? And again, if you think about these things, you know, let's think about them. Concern about the trustworthiness of our company. Okay. Concern about data privacy. Okay. And cost. Boy, a lot of those things sound like, you know, past things that were concerns that eventually created shadow IT. So I don't want to give you any advice about what you should do, right? But I think what will happen and what the sort of tension will have to get worked out is we are going to see plenty of instances of shadow AI. How people go about doing that will be different things. They'll do it on their phone. They'll use a second phone. They'll have a second laptop tethered to something. You have to accept people are going to go through ways to take advantage of technology if it helps them in one way, shape, or form. Maybe it helps them meet their quota. Maybe it helps them get their job done faster. Maybe it helps them offset a deficiency they have in knowledge, whatever that is. So we're going to see instances of shadow AI happen. Everything from, you know, how college kids cheat on exams to people doing homework to all kinds of things. So you have to expect that's going to happen. And you're going to have to expect that central IT doesn't necessarily know how to have, you know, a great conversation about it. They're not exactly sure what to do with it because it's all new and there's lots of misinformation out there, or unknown information. I don't want to say misinformation, but just lots of unknown. And they're going to be stricter than you want to be. And this is going to be a natural tension that we're going to have for several years. And just to put it into context, when cloud first came out and the concept of shadow IT came along, I mean, we were talking about shadow IT for 4, 5, 6, 7 years. Like, it wasn't sort of a 1 year phenomenon and then it went away because everybody kind of just got cool about things and they figured it out, right? So I think that's ultimately what we're going to have, and people are going to find the right tension between, you know, do I want to be more productive? Do I want to do some things? Does our group want to do some things? And how much trouble do we think we can get in if we get caught? And again, I'm not giving you any advice. I'm just simply saying there is some precedence here, some history that this has happened in the past, and I would expect that it will probably continue to happen in the future just because the incentives for, you know, what people consider to be valuable with AI are out there, and the incentives to, you know, stop certain aspects of what could happen as a byproduct of AI are also out there. And the two of those aren't necessarily diametrically opposed, and they're not necessarily of the same weight at this point, right? They're out there. So anyways, that's kind of where we stand on that. And again, that's just my general expectation, not my advice or guidance to you as to what you should do, right? Don't lose your job because of something the Cloudcast said. Don't get fired. Don't get sued. We will not. We are under no circumstances expecting to bail you out, or we're not giving advice around this. Last question. I will answer this real quickly. Do you have any plans to do any Cloudcast Basics series about some of the AI technologies? So real quick, for those of you that don't know, Aaron and I did a series of podcasts I think last year. They're in the show notes every week, whether you see them or not, called Cloudcast Basics. And so they are its own podcast series. It's on its own podcast feed. You can find it in all the same places that you find the Cloudcast. And it was entirely designed for people that are new to the industry that say, hey, if I want to learn some of this stuff, I like how you guys kind of teach things or frame things or use your experience, whatever it might be. Sorry, I'm laughing because I'm watching my dog chase one of the neighbor's dogs running down the street. And those of you that ask all the time about the dog barking, that's my dog. Anyways, I'm laughing about that because I'm just kind of watching it happen. Anyways, to answer the question, so Cloudcast Basics is out there. Yes, we do intend to probably do one at some point. We have to figure out, A, we have to get smart enough to do a Cloudcast Basics, which sounds funny, but in order to do something at the basic level, you kind of have to understand it at a pretty good level. And Aaron and I are still in the process of learning a lot of this stuff, like many of you are. But yeah, I do expect us to do a Cloudcast Basics around different aspects of AI in 2024, hopefully in the first half of 2024. So at least if somebody is new to stuff and they like the way that we've taught some of the other things, they can kind of learn from there. Again, they're freely available to you. Please share them with friends if you've got friends doing it. But yeah, we do intend to do it. We're working on a list. If you've got stuff that you'd like us to cover, again, show@thecloudcast.net helps. It's a way you can send us in feedback and so forth. But yeah, so we do intend to do that. So anyways, I've been going for a long time. Gosh, it's been 40 minutes. Apologize for going so long. Everything at the end of the year, we tend to do longer, partially because there's a lot to cover and partially because we know that you're in some downtime and maybe you're traveling or, you know, you're taking down Christmas decorations or whatever it might be. Sometimes people ask us for some longer ones. So with that, thank you all for listening. Thank you all for listening for the whole year. Thank you for telling friends and helping us grow the podcast. And you know, especially with this show, asking questions. You know, these have been a lot of interesting questions. We could probably go on with a lot more of them, but hopefully this gives you some perspective on a bunch of things that are relevant and interesting and interested in your space. So with that, I'll wrap it up. Thank you all for listening. Thank you for sending your questions. Thank you for being actively involved with the podcast. Thanks for being part of the community. Thanks for subscribing and rating and giving us 5 stars and all those other things that you're supposed to do around social media. So with that, we'll wrap it up. We'll talk to you next week.
Thank you for listening to The Cloudcast. Please visit thecloudcast.net to find more shows, show notes, videos, and everything social media.